The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week, well, we thought we'd take a quick break. Not just any old break, though. We thought we'd point you to our rich and extensive archive of podcasts. Almost 6 years of Science Weekly shows are available for you to explore. But to make that task a little easier, we've pulled out some great interviews that'll remind you of the plethora of science stories that we've brought you over the years. From immortal cells to our search for alien life. This is Science Weekly Revisited from The Guardian. In March 2009, the noted evolutionary biologist and author Olivia Judson joined the Science Weekly team, those were science correspondents Ian Sample, James Randerson and myself, to discuss her Sense About Science lecture, in which she claimed scientists were missing out in their quest for knowledge. They should, claimed Olivia, take more risks and work on the assumption that they're wrong. This would enable a greater culture of experimentation.
Well, I think that a lot of science is about curiosity and asking questions, and sometimes those questions are a bit silly. And I think I don't want to be a Darwin bore. I know everyone's been going on about Darwin in the last few weeks, but that's one
you
of
can't
that
have
was
too much Darwin, in my opinion.
Well, it was one of his characteristics. Was he had an absolutely superb curiosity, and he was actually rather unembarrassed about asking questions that other people would have thought were ridiculous. So, for example, he was studying sexual attraction between other animals, he pointed out that perhaps the red hinder ends of monkeys were attractive to other monkeys, and he remarked that he was aware that in saying so, he opened himself to ridicule.
But the idea you're saying is that you have to be a bit humble about when it comes to ideas. Sometimes ideas might sound completely stupid, but then they're proved to be correct through experimental.
I think that there are a lot of things that can inhibit our quest for knowledge, and possibly the two most important are internal, and one is talking yourself out of doing the experiment in the first place, and the other is not even asking the question.
So assumptions, essentially.
Yeah,
and you said assumptions. That assumptions are incredibly insidious. Now, can you give us a couple of examples of where that has sort of manifested itself?
I think it's manifested itself all over the place. I mean, in my own field, in evolutionary biology, and in particular in the evolution of sex, it was taken as read for an extremely long time that males were interested in sex and females weren't. And generally across the species, that was believed to be true. And then gradually, more and more DNA data started coming in showing that actually females were having a lot of sex with a lot of different males, and that this was not at all fitting with what people had expected. And I think that it was basically an assumption that females didn't like sex. It tells us more about our society than about the females.
Yeah. Was that a consequence of Darwin's, the age that Darwin was working in, and that he had to maybe he felt pressured to sort of express it that way and so as not to offend?
You mean females not wanting sex?
Yeah.
No, well, that endured until the 1980s.
Right.
I mean, that was an ongoing assumption. In fact, I don't think that Darwin shared it, because Darwin thought that his explanation for things like peacock's tails and indeed the hinder end of monkeys was that females had a sense of beauty, and that they were actively choosing who they were having sex with, whereas many people at the time, and indeed into the 1970s and 80s, thought that females were essentially passive, and males fought over them, and then females just kind of had sex with whoever was around, and they didn't really care.
You gave another interesting example in your comment piece last week, though, which was the Nobel Prize for working out the cause of stomach ulcers, which everyone assumed was something to do with stress, which actually is kind of rather Victorian notion, I think, anyway. But what happened there?
Well, so a couple of Australian scientists in the 1980s, doctors, started looking at stomach ulcers again, and it had been widely assumed that they were due to stress or excess stomach acid or something like that. And they noticed an association with bacteria in the stomach, and it was bacteria that was known to exist. Everyone assumed it was just a harmless commensal. But then one of the scientists decided that he was absolutely convinced that this was the cause of ulcers, and he decided to show it was by drinking some. And he made himself extremely ill, much more ill than, I mean, it was nearly a fatal mistake. But that was actually the moment at which it started to collect data to show that actually it wasn't just an association, there was a causal relationship.
Maybe that was an experiment he should have taught himself. But I don't know, he wouldn't be a Nobel Prize winner if he had.
I think that's right. I think there's a certain amount of chutzpah among most of the unexpected discoveries. And a lot of the time it comes down to sort of having the nerve to do the experiment.
The thing about science is that it is largely about consensus in many respects. Many discoveries are incremental. They sort of build upon something that's happened before. So for something like the discovery about ulcers, it completely changed what people thought. So no one believed these scientists for a very long time. But what they did do is go off and find data and do experiments. And eventually, you know, they persuaded the rest of the world. That kind of stuff, though, does it happen a lot in science, or is it something very rare? Are scientists still a conservative bunch?
I think there's a lot of variation. I think that there's a sociologist of science called Frank Soloway who argues that people who are the oldest in their families tend to be conservative, and they also tend to be sort of successful in traditional ways. So they tend to sort of run banks and do this and do that and the other, and they tend not to be terribly daring, whereas younger children tend to be more daring, more radical. And, for example, Darwin was not the oldest in his family. And Soloway did a beautiful graph that showed that people who were oldest children were much less likely to accept Darwin's ideas until about the 1930s, whereas people who were younger, pretty much all of Darwin's most ardent supporters were all also not oldest children. And so I think that depending on the ratio of who's doing science when, I think that there is a lot of conservatism, but I think it's also built into the funding process. You know, large amounts of money are being dispensed. People are basically paid to find fault with ideas. And there was Craig Venter, who became famous for his part in sequencing the human genome. He recounts in his autobiography how he published a paper on a way to look at very small pieces of DNA in the cell, or RNA in the cell. And he heard from somebody who had written a grant proposal to do the same thing and had got back a brutal critique, say it can't possibly work, about a week before Craig published his paper in Science. And so, you know, there's a lot of criticism. I mean, it's an intrinsically critical activity, but that creates conservatism, I think.
How do you weed out people who actually do have crazy ideas? For example, it's all very well to say that, for example, the ulcer story we talked about, that really was a case of they went against the scientific establishment for so long, but they did what good scientists do. They went and experimented, and they relentlessly found data that supported their argument. But there are lots of people always saying, oh, scientists aren't listening to what I'm saying. You know, there's lots of... I've disproved the theory of general relativity.
A lot of them write to me on a regular basis.
I was going to say, a lot of them write to us in pen and paper. And how do you weed out people who genuinely don't know what they're talking about? Or is that actually a risk, another risk you need to take?
Well, I think that, you know, it's a balance of probabilities, right? I mean, there are wacky ideas and wacky ideas, and the idea that a bacterium living in your stomach makes you ill isn't a terribly wacky idea.
But no one believed him.
I mean, nobody believed him for a long time.
The greatest scientists in the land, if you'd spoken to them at the time, would have said, that's just nonsense. So,
well, I think the main thing is that it just sort of, it helps, I think, to from time to time just kind of say, well, what am I taking for granted? How much do we really know?
If you want to find out more about Sense About Science, just go to their website, senseaboutscience.org. Another interviewee who pushed us to think outside the box was the cosmologist and astrobiologist Paul Davis. In spring 2010, he joined us to discuss his work on SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and also the publication of his book, The Eerie Silence. In his writing, Paul Davis really tests our popular assumptions about alien contact, probing our scientific understanding of why and how alien life and mankind would ever connect.
Maybe we're looking for the wrong thing in the wrong place at the wrong time. Maybe we should broaden the search and give up the idea that there are messages deliberately being sent our way, because E.T. doesn't know we're here. I think this is a really important point to get across, that when Drake and Carl Sagan and others began this work in the 60s and then developed it in the 70s, I think they very much had in mind that there might be some transmitting community maybe 100 light years away, something like that. I think that's optimistic. And even if we take Frank's estimate of 10,000 civilizations in the galaxy, that will put the nearest civilization quite likely to be, 1,000 light years away or more. And so if you're 1,000 light years away from Earth, you see Earth as it was 1,000 years ago. You don't see it as it is now.
The Battle of Hastings is just sort of happening.
Right. You see, there's no particular reason that they should be transmitting messages to Earth at that particular time. They would surely wait for our first radio signals to reach them before broadcasting something to us. So I think the idea of picking up a deliberate message is really a non-starter for a few thousand years. But we could look for beacons, for example. I think that's a better way to go. An advanced civilization might have a beacon, a bit like a lighthouse, that would sweep the plane of the galaxy with radio, not messages so much as a bleep, something that would just attract attention. But the SETI project's not well set up to look for such things because they're transient, you see. If somebody said, well, they heard a bleep in their radio telescope, fine, well, what do we do next? How do we confirm that? You have to keep a radio telescope directed at the same point of the sky, maybe for years before it goes bleep again. Just think of a lighthouse, but think on a long time scale. But nevertheless, we could think about doing that. But we could also look for what I call general signatures of intelligence, which is to say that to answer the question, are we alone in the universe, we don't have to get a message from ET. We just merely have to deduce that there is or was some sort of intelligent civilization out there in the galaxy. And so we can look for signs of intelligent activity. And the way I like to express it is that we look for anything that is fishy, anything that looks like it doesn't have a natural explanation. And I like to draw the analogy with a crime scene. Forensic scientists come along, there's a dead body. Did the person die of natural causes or was there foul play? They may have to look very carefully. There may be only very subtle clues that a crime was perpetrated. So we're looking for subtle clues, not that there's a crime out there in the galaxy, but that some particular process or phenomenon might not have a completely natural origin. And these may be very subtle signs.
This will be difficult given that we might not recognize the signatures of ET.
Right.
I mean, for example, if you were to fire a laser at someone 300 years ago, they might not know what it is.
Right.
So they might think it's a natural phenomenon anyway.
Yeah. So in the original conception of SETI, the assumption was that that we're the new kids on the block, and therefore ET, being so much farther ahead, would naturally signal us using primitive technology appropriate to our level of development. But if we're not talking about deliberate messages now, we're just talking about what a very advanced civilization might do and what sort of technological footprint it might make, then we do have our work cut out to guess what it might be. It may involve physical principles that we don't even understand yet. It may involve types of particles or waves we haven't yet discovered. But in science, you do what you can do. That is, you take the best of your scientific understanding at the time, and you work with that. What else can we do? We can't make up fairy stories about future science because the chances are we'll be wrong. So I think we have to work within our existing scientific framework, but even that encompasses a lot of things. So, for example, if we imagine the concept of the beacon is one where you don't have a particular recipient in mind, you just sort of put the news out there or the message out there. It's a calling card, really. There are many other ways that an advanced civilization could send us a calling card. For example, they may package the information in some sort of robot. It could be a spacecraft of a conventional sort, something about the size of a satellite, but I think much more likely would be some sort of nano probes. Because you can make them in their countless trillions and spread them around the galaxy. And these nanoprobes should ideally be self-repairing and self-replicating so that if there's a message or something to attract our attention, that it should be able to propagate and survive for hundreds of millions of years. You have to think on that sort of timescale in this game. Unfortunately, we know that such things already exist, that living cells are precisely repositories of information, they're little nanomachines. Viruses are even smaller. They can encapsulate quite a lot of information. We can imagine viruses being sent out and then injecting their message into the genomes of any organisms they may encounter.
So the first signs of ET we might get are some sort of plague or virus coming along to sort of instill knowledge from another world into
It wouldn't be knowledge. No, I think, first of all, again, we have to think on immense timescales. It could be that, say, 2 billion years ago, some viruses entered the solar system and inserted some of their RNA or DNA into living cells at that time. They were only just microbes. And that this information has been carried along inside the genomes of these microbes ever since. Well, we're sequencing microbes anyway, so why don't we just look and see if there's anything fishy in these genomes, in the microbes all around us. Now, obviously, it's a very fanciful hypothesis, but I think it's perhaps no more fanciful than that there are radio messages coming our way.
Well, let's talk a bit about the sort of beyond science stuff now. In science fiction, the story is always filled with aliens that can travel faster than light and mine energy from black holes and all of this. Stuff that for our sort of human engineering capabilities is impossible right now. It's not to say that physically these things might not be solved. I mean, what's the likelihood that these sort of science fiction staples will be true in alien civilizations? Or are there lines which even they could never cross?
Right. The laws of physics can't be broken by anybody. It's not a question of technology. And this is a really important distinction, and one that a lot of people don't make, the distinction between what might be physically impossible, because it breaks the laws of nature, and what might be technologically very hard. So you mentioned traveling faster than light. We believe that that is a fundamental law of the universe, and that however much money that you have, however developed your technology might be, there's nothing you can do about that. On the other hand, mining energy from black holes is a physically possible thing. It's a process I've actually studied in my own research. That is something that could be done. We can't do it, but it's not because it's violating any law. It's simply we haven't got enough money. We don't have access to a black hole. But given a super civilization with enormous resources, they could mine energy from a black hole.
The always brilliant insights there of Paul Davis. That interview is just one of hundreds on cosmology and space science, all still available for you online at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Now from astrobiology to cellular biology. In June 2010, I met the science writer Rebecca Skloot to discuss her book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. It took more than a decade of research to write, and it traced the history of one of the most important tools in basic biological research, the HeLa cell. This has had a profound impact on medical science and research in human biology. And it all began with Henrietta Lacks. But who was she?
Henrietta was a 30-year-old black woman who lived in Southern Virginia in the United States, and she grew up on the same tobacco farm that her ancestors had worked as slaves. And yeah, she didn't have much education. She would have had no idea what a cell was. And at 30, she was diagnosed with cervical cancer. And she went to the doctor, and this was at Johns Hopkins. She and her family had moved north to Baltimore in search of work for her husband. And she went to Hopkins, and yeah, the standard treatment of the day was radium therapy, where they would take tubes of radioactive material and literally sew those to the surface of the cervix and sort of leave them there for a few days. And before applying the radium, without telling her, her doctor just took a little slice of her tumor and put it in a dish and sent that down the hall to George Guy, who was the head of tissue culture research at Hopkins. And he'd been trying to grow human cells in culture for decades, and it had never worked. He could get them to survive for a few days, maybe a week. But even the ones that did survive, they would sort of not really do anything. They would sort of sit there and eventually die. And hers just took off. Within a few days of leaving the hospital, her cells were doubling their numbers every 24 hours. So they went from, you know, one dish to two to four to eight to 16, and they just grew with this incredible intensity that no one had ever seen.
And what made her cells so special? I mean, maybe they didn't know at the time, but in the years since, have they discovered what it is that makes her cells so special?
Not really. It's still a bit of a mystery. We know a few things about them. One is that she had HPV, the virus that causes cervical cancer, and her cells have multiple copies of the HPV genome
inserted into the
cells. Yeah. And so there are some scientists who've said, well, maybe there's something about her having, you know, multiple copies of this viral genome that made her cells grow intensely. But she also had syphilis, which can weaken your immune system and cause cancer to grow more rapidly. But so did a lot of people in the 50s. And, you know, their cells didn't just grow like this. And, you know, today, it turns out cervical cancer cells in particular are very hard to grow. So other people who've had HPV, their cells didn't do this. So there's still a bit of a mystery. There's something about her cancer mixed with the HPV that just took off in a way that scientists don't really know. And it's funny, I talk in front of groups of scientists all the time, and occasionally this will come up and they'll look at each other and just be like, we don't know that? Why don't we know that? Like, we know everything else about Hila. Why can't we answer that question? So hopefully they'll come up with a good answer soon.
And so the story of the cells goes in one direction. Well, what happened to before we go into that, what happened to Henrietta Lacks? How long did she survive after that biopsy?
Yeah, her cancer grew with the same kind of intensity in her body that it did in the lab. And when she first went in, her tumor was about the size of a nickel. And within just a few months, every organ in her body had been taken over by this tumor, and she died just after her 31st birthday and left 5 kids behind. She never knew the cells grew. No one had told her kids that they had grown. And, you know, her cancer, there was something about the cancer that, you know, like the cells, her doctor, he's 99 years old now, he still very clearly remembers her cancer. He just said, I've never seen a cancer spread like hers spread, grow as fast, and, you know, have the kind of intense symptoms. I mean, she was in a lot of pain. It was a really difficult death.
The cells were then cultured, as you said, by Dr. Guy. Did he ever meet Henrietta Lacks?
That is also a little bit of a mystery. Everyone that I talked to said no, he never met her. It wouldn't have been something that he would have done. But there's one woman who he worked with who said she very clearly remembers him telling her that he went to Henrietta's bedside at one point once he knew that the cells were going to be as important as they were, and that he told her, you know, your cells will make you immortal, they'll live forever and help people, and that she said that was a good thing and made her happy, which, you know, would be in line.
Do you believe that?
Right. I mean, who knows? There's no reason why this woman would have made that up. It's definitely in line with both of their personalities. I mean, George Guy, that is something I could see him having done. But, you know, where the story, I can see her being happy that the cells would help someone, but she wouldn't have understood what a cell was. She wouldn't have understood what immortality was. By that point, she was also so heavily medicated, she wouldn't have been, none of it would have seemed even real to her. She was on so much morphine and various other drugs. But I don't disbelieve it. I could see it happening.
I mean, the story of the Lacks family obviously continues after that. We'll come back to that a bit later. But let's talk about the cells again. So at what point did Dr. Guy realize that this was the immortal cell line that he'd spent several decades with his wife looking for?
Yeah, it took a little while. They started growing and growing. Like, his wife described them as growing like crabgrass that they just sort of took over the laboratory. And he was very kind of hesitant to be excited about it for quite a while. But after a few months of this, he realized what he had and started telling other scientists. And they all immediately just said, can we have some? And he did. He just gave them to any researcher anywhere in the world who wanted to use them for research. And, you know, today you go online, you order some cells, they send it to you by mail. But you know, that wasn't the case at the time. He or his wife or his assistant would go to the airport with tubes of cells.
There's quite a nice detail you had in the book about pilots putting them
exactly
in their pockets to keep them warm.
Right. He would go to, right. And the idea of this happening today, you know, in the high security, you know, world is sort of impossible to imagine. But yeah, he would just go up to a pilot or a flight attendant and say, will you put this tube in your pocket and fly it to, you know, Minneapolis or London or wherever. And scientists would wait on the other end, grab the cells, run back to their labs and grow them and give them to their friends who give them to their friends. And they really quickly spread all over the world that way.
I mean, the idea of a cell culture might seem quite clear, that you could then do things to the cells and in terms of research, whether it's looking at toxins or the effects of certain environmental contaminants or whatever, you could do all sorts of research with these cells. But why are cancer cells useful in this respect? Because, I mean, the cancer cells are essentially cells that have gone wrong.
Right. It is very sort of counterintuitive to think that there's all this incredible research that on other diseases that came from cancer cells. And some of it is that there are things that are normal about HeLa cells. I mean, there's a lot that's abnormal because they're cancer. But, you know, they have cell membranes that viruses have to get through just like any other cell. They produce proteins and they metabolize things. And so the things that they do that normal cells do, you can study in the cancer cells. And in fact, the fact that they're cancer in some cases makes them more useful for that because they do everything faster. In the 50s in particular, one of the things that they were so useful for was viral research. And they can work like little factories. You infect them with a virus and they grow, the cells grow and grow, and they, the virus grows with them. So they can mass produce virus, and then you can extract that from the cells, or enzymes, or various other things. And the range of what you can do with HeLa cells to this day is, it is sort of amazing. Now scientists can actually alter them and turn them into, make them behave like, you know, a heart cell or a brain cell or a normal cell. So there are ways to use them and change them.
So essentially they're biological machines, yeah. And they just happen to replicate very well. But and you don't worry about the fact that they've got extra chromosomes. And...
Yeah, for some things you do. I mean, there's definitely some research that it just wouldn't be appropriate to use. But yeah, they're sort of like fruit flies, you know, white lab mice. I mean, they're a workhorse that provides this baseline. It's like, you know what HeLa is, you know how it grows, it's sort of predictable. And so the way, when you expose it to something and then it changes, you know where you started from. And it's cheap and it's easy to grow a lot of it.
Which is even more surprising then, that the scientists don't really know why this happens, right. Given that it might be an interesting, well, I mean, obviously it's not that important in terms of the cures and the research that's been done on them, but it seems mm-hmm. to be a bit of a black hole. Is anyone looking at this?
Well, yeah, it's funny. I think some of it is that when they first grew, people were just so excited that they finally had the cells. They were like, you know, the last thing they wanted to figure out was why they grew. They're like, we just want to use them for other things. And then since then, they're just everywhere. They're just sort of, you know, you've got the test tubes, you've got the HeLa cells. And so they've been there for so long that people just don't really, I think, stop to think about where they came from or why. And but yeah, as I've gone around and talked to these scientists and this question comes up, a few of them have said, okay, I'm going to try to get you a better answer to that question, because there's obviously a reason.
There's a hint, isn't there? There's a hint yeah. in your book about telomeres and mm-hmm. a specific enzyme that sort of is running, which means that normally when cells divide, the sort of caps at the end of the chromosomes get shorter and shorter until eventually, if they're too short, they can't divide again. Whereas with HeLa cells, that doesn't happen at all.
Right, all cancer cells. And so, right, so we know that part of why cancer cells just grow and grow and grow is because, right, their telomeres get rebuilt as they get shortened, so they just never get old and never die. So mechanically, we know that's why her cells stay alive. But why that happened in her cells outside of the body when it didn't in others, even other cancer cells, that's where the mystery is. Yeah.
Now, it's all not all of it is good news in terms of the fact that this cell is so good at reproducing. It seems to have contaminated millions and millions of dollars and pounds worth of research all over the world. Tell us a bit about that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's so after the HeLa cells were first grown, scientists began growing a sort of library of other tissues. They would take samples from, you know, prostates and breast cancer cells, and because they wanted to have a lot of different kinds of tissues to study. And at some point in the late 60s, one scientist realized that they were basically almost all HeLa cells, and that scientists, without realizing it, had been growing and regrowing HeLa, thinking they were growing other things.
How did they get there?
Because cells can float on dust particles in the air. If you touch a dish and then don't wash your hands and you go touch another dish, you can transfer them from one to the other. If you use a pipette, you know, the device they use to suction cells out, and then you go reuse it with another kind of cell, you can transfer them. And HeLa cells grow so powerfully that they just take over. So if just one or two HeLa cells fall into a dish, they'll just grow and grow and essentially outgrow anything that's in there and take over. And you can't really tell from the outside, just looking with the naked eye. So yeah, this caused millions of dollars in damage and a lot of controversy because it called some research results into question. And this is actually what eventually led to tracking down Henrietta's kids, was an effort to sort out the problem. They wanted to use DNA from her kids to develop a test to see what was HeLa and what wasn't. But I'm sure we'll talk about that. But and to this day, contamination is still a big problem in research labs.
Well, let's go back to her family. So after the cells were taken they went off in the direction we've described, what happened to her family? When did the family themselves come back into the scientific questioning?
Not for a long time. So Henrietta died in 51, and in the early 70s, in order to settle this controversy about the contamination, one scientist decided to track down her kids to get DNA samples from them. And he figured he could sort of treat it like a crime scene. And if the cells out there matched her kids' DNA, then they were obviously from their mother. And so he sent a postdoc of his to call Henrietta's family to get samples. And, you know, Henrietta's husband had a third grade education. He didn't know what a cell was. And he got this phone call one day. And the way he understood it was, we've got your wife. She's alive in a laboratory. We've been doing research on her for the last 25 years, and now we have to test your kids to see if they have cancer, which wasn't what the scientist said at all. She said, we need to look at their HLA markers and compare those to the HeLa cells. And He thought they had Henrietta in a cell, like a prison cell. That was the only kind of cell he'd ever heard of. So his family got sucked into this world of research that they didn't understand, and the scientists didn't realize that the family didn't understand. So it was this, it went on for years.
Completely different world. Mm-hmm. And it's, but the family got involved in the research again, did they?
Well, so it went on for years. The scientists would come and take samples and leave, and it went beyond that identification of cell contamination. So that it did, you know, they did determine, yes, that the HeLa cells had taken over. But then scientists started hearing, oh, someone has access to her kids, and I'd like DNA for some other research related to HeLa cells. And so the scientists would come back, and it went on like that for quite a long time. And, you know, eventually the family sort of realized she wasn't alive. They couldn't go visit her, you know, in the way she'd been before she died. But they didn't understand what it meant to have part of her alive. And her daughter, in particular, was very worried that the research being done on the cells would actually cause her mother some sort of pain. She worried, you know, when you infect her with her cells with the polio virus, does that then cause her mother to feel the symptoms of polio wherever she is in the afterlife? And can she rest in peace if all this is going on? And the family never got really answers to those questions. The other thing that came up with that was quite difficult for them was the issue of money. So in addition to all the important science done on the cells, they were the first ever commercialized. So we now have this, you know, enormous industry based on buying and selling tissues and cells, patenting genes. And it started with her cells, but her children to this day don't have any money.
So
and
companies have made billions from her cells, but her family still, as you say in the book, can't afford health insurance.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a hard irony for them to, sort of live with.
The very moving story of Henrietta Lacks and her immortal cells, which contributed so much to science. Rebecca Skloot's book is available from many reputable online retailers and published by Pan Books. Well, I hope you enjoyed our journey into the Science Weekly back catalogue. All the shows you've heard from are just a click away and free to stream or download. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can, of course, keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.